My name's Sue, I'm an addict.
Hi, Sue.
And I think right now I'd rather be sitting anywhere else than sitting in this terribly hot, airless room with these ventilators. I always think this when I'm here, that those vents everywhere, it looks like some poison gas is going to come in at any point. But that probably says something about my state of mind. It's not, you know, I'm a really unsociable person. I really am. I've never been the sort of person who goes to parties or... I was sort of thinking about this in my head just now, and I was thinking, yes, that's why I took drugs, so I could go to parties. It wasn't. But the reality is it was very, very hard for me, and it still is, sort of thinking... feeling like a fraud, feeling like I don't fit in anywhere. There's nowhere that I feel, whether it's in my family, anyone else's family, in work, studies, social situations, I always feel wrong. That's my default position. And even coming here, I'm sort of thinking, I mean, these are not the only thoughts that go on in my head. There are about 50 million thoughts all going on at once. But these are the familiar ones. And these are the ones I want to talk about here because these are the ones I think you guys identify with. Because these are the sort of things that I heard when I first came to meetings. And I kept coming back because I heard other people having the same fears, the same worries, the same anxieties. That I had and that I covered up with my drug use. When I was growing up, I couldn't say to anyone that I found social situations difficult. Can I hold this?
Yes.
That's better. Now I can relax because I'm sitting back. I like to appear laid back. And that's the feedback that I've always had throughout my life, is that, you know, you're really laid back. I remember a cookery teacher, or domestic science, or whatever they called it, food technology, at school saying, well, you're never going to have a heart attack. I mean, she didn't know what was going on in my head, but she knew that the way I was peeling those potatoes was sort of quite laid back and a bit inept. And you know, we talk about judging our insides by other people's outsides. People often say to me, and I get really pissed off about this. I just said pissed off, is that okay?
Please swear away.
Thanks, David. That'd be a good impression. And I get really pissed off about that because, you know, people often look at me and think, well, you don't look nervous or you don't look anxious, and I wish I could do whatever it is you've just done without appearing nervous. And I'm like, you're joking. I feel like I'm about to implode from the inside out. And, you know, thinking about coming along here and having to identify myself as an addict and talk to people about I've been clean a long time. I got clean in 1988. And one of those voices in my head is saying, well, you know, you've got to share experience, strength and hope, and you've got to tell them all what you did and how to do it, and this is the NA way. And that's very hard when you've got these voices going on saying, well, actually, you're a fraud, you're an imposter. You're not really clean. You're still using. And the other voice that's saying, well, actually, you never used in the first place. That is, you know, if I chose to listen to these voices, I think I would be using today. Because those voices don't, for me, those voices haven't stopped in recovery. But what has got better and what's got a million times better is that I don't have to listen to them. Or maybe I don't have a choice of whether listening to them. But I have a choice over whether I believe them or not. And when I hear that refrain going on in my head, like, oh, you're just crap, you're not good enough, you're blah, 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 I think, well, this might not be going to change, but I know it's not true. And I know it's not true because I've had enough experience of hearing other voices, of hearing voices from people like you, who give me feedback. And before I start getting too esoteric and wandering off into hyperspace, coming here tonight, you know, I was thinking, I hate going to the West End. I didn't do any using in the West. I grew up in Liverpool and came to London in 1980 with my husband, my three-month-old son, and I was also pregnant with my second son. And I was an intravenous heroin user. It didn't get any better. In fact, it got a lot worse. And those early years in London were the rock bottom of my using. But during my using, you know, I didn't go to the West End. I didn't go to clubs in London. It's not somewhere which is part of my experience. And, you know, a couple of days ago, I was looking through photographs. And I was looking through these photographs, and I found this photograph of myself in Trafalgar Square in the mid-70s, standing in Trafalgar Square, as you do, and get your photograph taken. In those days, there were pigeons there. And I'm standing in Trafalgar Square with this sort of grin on my face. And actually, I'd just come back to England from Amsterdam, where I managed to acquire my first heroin habit, got back to London, and was actually withdrawing. And looking at this photograph, I was thinking, what? All I can think is that I was young, I was in love, I was with my boyfriend, and it was my first habit. You know, fast forward 10 years to my millionth time of withdrawing, because I spent a lot of my using time withdrawing. I wasn't very good at, I was never a dealer, I wasn't very good at making money or getting drugs, and I still don't have that sort of business-minded gene that some people manage to have. I've never had that, and it's not in my family, so I didn't inherit it. But looking at this photograph of this young woman, I'm thinking, what was going on in her head? You know, what happened there? And, you know, that was the beginning of my serious using. I'd used for a few years before that, but my serious using for me, when it got really bad, was when I picked up my drug of choice. I say my drug of choice, but I think I probably spent more of the next 10 years actually not using my drug of choice and being sick and using anything else I could get my hands on to try and make myself feel better. And it didn't work. It stopped working very early on. I mean, before that, I'd always been in a relationship. I'd always had a boyfriend when I was 16. And that sort of worked for me. But I always chose men who were using, who used drugs, who were like me, basically. When I was growing up, I always thought, I only had three ambitions. They were to either be a drug addict, go mad, or get pregnant. And, I mean, that's really sad looking back, thinking about that, because that was the only way I knew of getting my needs met and feeling that someone would look after me. And that's not to say, that's not to say I was physically neglected, I was fed, I was looked after, I wasn't in a children's home, but there were lots of things in my life that were difficult for me. There's lots of theories about the sort of psychological differences between men and women, that men who are in distress tend to lash out, and women who are in distress tend to hurt themselves. And I don't know about everyone else, but that was certainly the case for me is that, you know, I hurt myself with food, sex, relationships and drugs. And I was in pain. I was in pain about who I was. I didn't feel that I didn't feel that I was meant to be alive. I'd never met my father. My mother and father were teenagers when I was born. And my father's American, and he went back to the States shortly after I was born. And my mother couldn't take care of me in those days. There were no benefits, and I ended up living with my grandparents. And there was always a feeling of not being good enough, of things not fitting in. And they were the sort of feelings that contributed to this, my sense of wrongness and feeling wrong. So when drugs came along, and alcohol first came along and I had my first drink, suddenly everything fell into place, everything started feeling all right, and I started feeling good about myself. I could talk to people, I could do the sort of things that I thought everyone else out there was doing, that everyone else out there was out there having a good time, going to these parties, which I didn't was terrified of doing. You know, someone asked me recently about, you know, in no ways do I think I'm an expert on recovery, or this is how to do it, this is how. But recently I was thinking about honesty, open-mindedness and willingness, because I think that's the most important thing to me. And it suddenly came to me, honesty, open-mindedness and willingness stands for how. And it was like this huge revelation. Now, I must have heard that about a billion times over the last 25 years, or longer, because I've actually been coming to meetings for about 28 years. And suddenly it was like a big light bulb went off in my head that honesty, open-mindedness and willingness stands for how. And that's what I like about recovery, is that every now and then I will have that sort of revelation. And I like to think these sort of revelations come from my belief in a higher power, that I was very ill 2 years ago. Two and a half years ago, I was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, and they told me that I had an 8% chance or surviving. And that obviously wasn't what I wanted to hear. And it was the start of a long process that took about a year and a half of treatment. And I did everything that was suggested. I did the conventional treatment, and I did the alternative treatment. And here I am today. I had a bone marrow transplant 2 years ago. And so far, by the grace of my higher power, I'm here today and I'm well. But something that was familiar to me during that time was something that I learned in this fellowship. And that was that through the process of honesty, open-mindedness and willingness, I've had grace bestowed on me. Now that grace, it's not something I wear every day. It's not something like, I don't know, what do I wear every day, like my bra or something. It's not something like my bra that I put on every day. But it's something that is bestowed on me when I surrender to that program and that place. When they told me that I had an 8% chance of living, I surrendered to that place where grace was bestowed on me. And I learned that in the those rooms, because when I first, you know, when I first got clean, I'd struggled for. My second son was born in 1981, and he was really badly affected by my using before he was born, and he was really ill when he was born and nearly died. And I swore then that I wasn't going to use again, because I'd always said one of the things that I believed would fix me was having a baby. And then, you know, I go and have two children in rapid succession and continue using drugs in the most damaging way. And I always said that I wouldn't hurt those children, that I would do something very, you know, my parents abandoned me and there was no way I was going to abandon my children, I was going to be there for them. What did I do? I've got this illness, which is not an excuse, it's an explanation. And when this happened, when 1981, when my son was born, I swore then that I wasn't going to use, I was going to get clean. Not that I knew what clean was at that time. I didn't have a concept of being clean. That was 1981. I didn't get clean till 1988, so it took me another 7 years. And those last 7 years of my using, you know, any vestiges of fun or any vestiges of fun or illusions that using drugs was going to stop those voices in my head and that way of not being able to engage in the world, they'd all gone in 7 years. It's 7 years that I tried to stop using. Obviously, during those 7 years, I didn't surrender. I wasn't willing. You know, quite a few people came forward in those days to try and help me. I remember people from Drugs Projects coming round to my house, the local pharmacist, my doctor. Lots of people asked me, did I need help? Could they help? And because I couldn't work out how I was going to stop using, it's like I heard you say, Thomas, someone asked you, did you need help? And you said no. And it was similar for me in that I didn't know anyone who'd stop using. People I used with either died or continued using. I didn't know anyone who'd stopped using. So when people offered to help me, I didn't think it was possible. So by the time I got to these rooms, it was 7 years that I'd struggled. So when I finally threw in the towel, by coming to meetings, by hearing other people talking about...
How long have I got left?
20 minutes. 15 minutes.
Okay. So when I first came to meetings and heard, let's be honest here, I'm talking about honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. When I came to my first meeting in 1983, I think it was, I went to my first meeting in Chelsea because someone told me about this fellowship. And I went to my first meeting in Chelsea and there's no way I identified anything because I wasn't ready. I was still... I was saying the drugs have stopped working for me, but I wasn't willing to open my ears and hear what other people were saying. And when people came up to me after the meeting and offered to help me, I didn't believe them. I didn't believe that they had ever used drugs. Why on earth I thought they were an NA meeting, I don't know. But it took me, you know, it took me another 5 years after that to actually throw in the towel and surrender. And during that time, one person that I'd actually used with got clean and took me to a meeting. And then I kept going back slowly, very slowly. First of all, every 2 or 3 months, and then once a month, and then once a week. And I was on a methadone script at the time, and very, very slowly that methadone script got right down to 5 mils. 2 mils, 1 mil, I went right down to the
the very, very end of it. And that was my, you know, that's how I did it. And my first day clean was June the 6th, 1988. And I went to a meeting that night. And I went to a meeting. Well, I attempted to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I think I did about 86 or something. And I went to those meetings and I had these two small children with me and it was hard. And my husband was still using and we were still living together and we had these two small children. And I went to 86 meetings in 90 days because I knew that what I was hearing in these rooms were stories from people who'd been in a similar place to me and people who'd been in worse places to me. You know, people who'd been in prison, people who'd lost their children. I was very fortunate when I came, I still had my relationship, although how fortunate that was at the time, I don't know. But, you know, I still had my children with me and I still had my health. But I had those early days of hearing other people talking about what had happened to them and what they were doing now. What they were doing differently now, with that program of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to be able to make these changes, because you know it's really, really hard to give up anything. You know, I was talking to someone today about giving up coffee. You know, and that's hard. That's hard. But giving up any active addiction, and an active addiction that has taken us to hell and back, and I think. You know, I probably speak for everyone in here. I don't think any of us would be here if we hadn't been to hell and back. Who wants to come and sit in? Who wants to come and sit in these rooms if we hadn't been to hell and back? But this is the solution because my drug use took me to hell. At first, it started off. My drug using was a solution. Was a solution to those attacking voices in my head. That feeling of not feeling good enough, wanting to. Take something to relax me. You know, when we get in hospital. Though having said this, when I first went into hospital to be treated for the leukemia, and I'm very grateful to the hospital and I'm very grateful to the health service and everyone who was there. But it was barbaric. When I first went in hospital, they didn't give me anything to take the edge off that roaring, screaming fear. It was actually, I think it was possibly worse than withdrawing. Being taken into hospital and told that you had an 8% chance of living and they were going to tunnel this big catheter thing into your chest and then they were going to give you all these chemicals that could kill you and one of the side effects was you could go blind or this might happen or that might happen and you'd probably die anyway. And at the same time, you're Googling everything or online and hearing all these stories from people who went blind, their legs dropped off, their whatever, and then suddenly their blogs had stopped because they died. And I can tell you, that was scary. And they didn't give me anything, you know, they didn't give me anything to sedate me, and I'm like, you know, I'm an addict. Well, I mean, they didn't even offer me anyone to speak to, never mind giving me any drugs to sedate me. And after a little while, when it got better, and I got, was it, you know, this is where the grace came in. The grace from my higher power was bestowed on me. And through all you people, you know, there's so many angels in this room and outside that room who supported me during that time. And what one of the nurses said to me is, you know, we have people who come in here and we have to sedate them because they're so distressed with what's going on. We have to sedate them. And you know what? Those people we sedate, they don't make it. They don't live. And that sort of made sense to me. That's not to say I didn't take the drugs when they offered them to me. And, you know, I did take the drugs for medicinal purposes when I was in hospital, and I was very grateful for them. But there's a difference between using medication when needed and using it like we did to sedate ourselves, to get away from that distress. And it was really a sobering thought to me when this nurse said, you know, those people that we sedated didn't make it. And so when, you know, I came to, finally cleaned up 1988, put down that last bit of methadone and followed all the suggestions. Got a sponsor, went to meetings, worked the steps, did everything. You know, that's The bottom line is following the suggestions, doing everything I was told. Because, you know, I'm an all or nothing sort of person. I can use whatever it is, or I can not. And when I did this alternative treatment as well as the conventional treatment for my leukemia, and I went to a clinic in the States and did a raw food diet, and I was told there that, you know, if I ate a tomato, I'd die. I came home and I didn't eat a tomato because I'm an all or nothing sort of person, you know? And it was like that in NA. You know, when I first got clean, my sponsor, people would say to me, you know, I'd hear people in the room saying, if you, all the cliches, all the suggestions, everything I hear in the rooms, I follow because I was too frightened not to do anything, and it worked for me. And you know, I wasn't willing to take that risk that if I was dishonest. And that doesn't mean, you know, at first I thought honesty was about saying how I felt, so if anyone asked me, how are you, I'd have to tell them, well, actually, this is, you know, and I'd go into a 10-minute share with the man in the greengrocers if he asked me how I was. After a while, I realised that, you know, that's not what we mean when we talk about honesty. When we talk about honesty, we talk about honesty in all our dealings. So, you know, I didn't continue to claim benefits when I was working, or not pay my rent, or steal from the petty cash in work, or all those dishonesties, or you know, sleep with married men, or whatever is dishonesty. And that's what I did, and that's, you know, a day at a time. That's how it worked, and that's how it continues to work. And, you know, I've been in recovery a long time, so most of the time today my battle's on with whether I'm going to pick up. You know, I can walk past a pub, I don't have any desire to go in and get drunk, I don't, you know, the thought of using drugs just doesn't, most of the time, doesn't enter my head. I still want to take something to make me feel better, with the coffee and the cake and all that sort of thing coming, or the geographicals, or go on holiday, or buy something. All those things still come into my head, and I still act out on some of them on a daily basis, unfortunately. I'm not perfect, but what I've learned in these rooms is that I can't fix myself with drugs. Because what I thought was the solution just ended up in a really big problem. And what's been happening for me in recovery is a period of, I've done a lot of things differently. You know, I left school with very few qualifications. In recovery, in the last 25 years, I've done 3 degrees and 2 professional qualifications. And I'm not saying that to boast, or just a little. Because I'm pretty amazed looking back, because I'm not, I actually don't like academic work. I love reading. I still read for escape, but I don't like reading academic texts. I still couldn't even quote you anything out of the basic text, you know. So I managed to do those 3 degrees without remembering anything, but I've done all right. But I say that because it's using the principles that I learned in recovery, turning up a day at a time, finding out where my next class is, what I need to do, following the suggestions, and that's how I've done it. And the other thing I've been doing, and recently I need to talk about this before, I think I've got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got 5 minutes to talk about this. The big, huge thing that's going on in my life at the moment is that I've never met my birth father. And about 20 years ago, I managed to get in touch with him. And he lives in America, he's American, and at that time he didn't really want to have any other contact with me. And but he kept in touch, he kept in touch, so I'd get a Christmas card from him every couple of years, or I And, you know, a few months ago, he and my mother turned 80 recently, and given that I'd been really ill, and I started thinking, you know, will I regret this? If, over the last few years, that boyfriend that I had in Amsterdam, that I hadn't seen for 30-odd years, I met up with him when I went to this clinic in the States to get treatment for my leukemia. By huge series of coincidences, he was living down the road from this clinic. I hadn't had any contact with him for 30 years since he'd abandoned me in Mexico City, and I'd got repatriated, and it was all very mad. And over the years, I'd always wondered what had happened to him. To cut a long story short, we met up, and the most gratifying healing thing for me was to be able to speak to this man and have him say that he hadn't forgotten me, that he apologised for what had happened, and that he was actually pretty fond of me. And, you know, we're both, it wasn't like a romantic thing. My husband was very pleased to hear that I didn't fancy this man. and he's not in recovery. He's not in recovery, so that was interesting. But the nice thing, the healing thing for me, was that relationship, which had been in there somewhere, that was there in the mix, and that was unhealed, and that was like, that was in my false debt, that was a resentment, that was something that contributed to me not feeling good enough about myself. And there was real healing that went on in that relationship. So a couple of months ago, I thought, you know, will I regret it if I'm on my deathbed and I've never met my father? So I contacted him and suggested that we meet up. And a few weeks went by, and then I got a letter from a lawyer suggesting that we took a DNA test, and we did. And about 3 weeks ago, we got the results of that test, and it was positive. And something really shifted for me. Something really shifted for me in that things fell into place about who I am and who I, you know, and suddenly we this man showing up anyway, after not showing up for all these years, he wanted the DNA test so that he could bring it all out in the open and he could tell his family. I've got 3 sisters and a brother in America, and he wanted to tell them, but he wanted to be sure first. And, you know, the day after we got the results of this DNA test, I woke up the next morning, and there's all these requests on my Facebook page from my brothers and, no, my sisters and my nephews and nieces in the States who want to be friends. And on Tuesday just gone, I spoke to my father for the first time in my life, and we spoke for an hour, and it was really, I don't have the adjectives to describe that at the moment, but it was good. And we're making plans for one of my sons and I to go over there and visit. And one of the things, one of my new nephews, and while all this was going on over the last 3 weeks, one of my new nephews, who's about 25, had just been bussed for manufacturing methamphetamine and was in court, and the whole family went there, and he was sentenced to go to rehab for a year rather than prison, because the family was supporting him and his sister's a lawyer and blah, blah, blah. And one of my new sisters had seen on Facebook a picture of my husband, and there was an NA. Never mind the anonymity, there was something about NA on it, and she asked me if I had, if we had experienced a recovery. And now, you know, before I came out of the house tonight, this young man who's in a rehab in West Virginia is messaging me to say he's about to go to a meeting, and do I have any tips for him, and so it goes. And, you know, I really hope I've been of service tonight. I don't want to do this too often. It's a year since I last did it. Thanks, Ali, for asking me last August. And when I was asked to do it this year, I said, well, I've only just done it, and it was a year ago. Maybe I can relax now till next August at least. Please don't, you know, one ask me again. But I hope I've been of service, and I hope I've said something that people can identify with. Thanks for asking me, and thanks for taking the meeting, David, and thanks, Thomas. Thank you.